The following presentation is brought to you by Priority One.
Good evening. We're here a little bit early this week to attempt to deal with some issues from listeners. And just by way of introduction, I would like to mention that as the weeks and the months of this series have unfolded, it's become clearer to many, many people that there are many serious issues out there. Everything is not as smooth sailing as we would have hoped. In fact, one might even think that the success of the Torah communities and the Torah establishment and the yeshivas and day schools throughout the country, in a sense, is partially responsible for some of our problems. We have succeeded. We've become the establishment. And many of our kids are just finding it not fitting perfectly for them. It's a fit that fits for most, but the individual sometimes has trouble for it. And there are many things that position them, if you will, for failure in the system. Many of these positions are beginning to develop today, and a lot of our kids are getting in trouble. And that's why we feel that whatever we could do in terms of prevention, early detection and earlier intervention, we probably could save a lot of grief and help a lot of people. One of the most critical issues in the development of our children is maybe the lack, or maybe the not complete development of good midos. You know, as the establishment has become very, very frum, and as chumrah and especially the outward manifestation of piety and religiosity have become of such significance, and it is, sometimes the emphasis on the midos, on the character, on the sterling traits of character, which are the hallmark of Torah, are sometimes avoided. It becomes too difficult to pay attention to them. Not everybody is attuned to it. Not everybody thinks that it's as important as these outward manifestations of one's frumkeit. And unfortunately, what that leads to is a desensitizing of our children. It leads to a lack of appreciation of the midah hakoras hatoiv. It leads to a lot less chesed, which leads to a lot less happiness, because chesed happens to be one of the giving happens to be one of the most validating and therefore happiness inducing of so many midos. It leads to a lot less truth, because if the midas emes is not paramount, then the truth of what we are or what we are not supposed to do in life is also not of such a great significance. So therefore, it's very important for us to spend some time focusing on the development, on the potential for development of good midos. The truth is that when the Torah says, Kosomar lebeis Yaakov esagid lebnei Yisrael, we read it in last week's Parsha, speak to the Beis Yaakov, which it refers to the women first and then the Bnei Yisrael, the Rabbeinu Yonah says that the reason the women were taught the Torah first was because ultimately they have the responsibility for the passing on of Torah to future generations. Now, seems to be a bizarre concept, because the men are mechuyev in teaching, not the women. But he says because the mother has her child at the most formative and critical years, when the traits of character are implanted and developed in these children, and she spends more of the time with them during that critical time, and therefore she is responsible more for their midos development. And he continues and says, it's the midos that make the difference in the survival and the passing on of Torah to future generations. And without these midos being intact, without them being properly developed, the Torah really will not survive. The Torah requires a sense of truth in its adherence in those who observe it. And if there isn't a sense of truth, then what's right and what's wrong and what's proper and what's improper is not really relevant, because truth doesn't matter. And the Torah is tchiloso gmilos chasodim v'soifo gmilos chasodim, Chazal say. It's from beginning to end, it's all about chesed. And one who doesn't have this midas hachesed cannot really fully participate and be comfortable with what Torah is. And the same thing applies to so many other midos, certainly the midah of hakoras hatoyif. If a person doesn't have the ability to recognize and appreciate the good that's being done for him or her, then they certainly don't feel the need to reciprocate with the observance of Torah and mitzvahs, and it goes on and on. So these are things which are critical in the development of our children and the earliest stages of life. The formative years of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, those are really the years when so many of these midos are developed. It's very important to recognize, as I believe we mentioned previously, that the formation and development of midos is very directly related to the acts that express and make one use to these midos. If we train our family in truth, truth is a paramount value. Nobody lies in this house. To lie in this house is considered the ultimate sin. It just isn't done. It cannot be tolerated. Then the midah of emes takes root. And when someone does lie, it's duly noted, not insulted and not broken, but just that it's inappropriate. We can't have relationships if they're not based upon truth. And when someone is truthful, despite embarrassment or other serious repercussions, and that is rewarded with something, the reward that means something to a kid, then that lesson is implanted in them, that truth is something that is a very worthy characteristic and something that they really should develop. And the same thing with chesed. Acts of chesed make our children into Baalei Chesed, into people sensitive to others, into people caring of others. And the more the opportunities that we give them to do acts of Chesed, the more that we share with them the Chasodim that we do and allow them to participate, it's certainly to this to that degree that they become more Baalei Chesed. And when it comes to the Mido of Hakoras HaToiv, the same thing is true. If we teach brochos as ritual, then it doesn't mean very much to them. But if we describe to them the gifts of life, if we share with them all of the precious, the nuances of all the precious chasodim that HaKadosh Baruch Hu does to us, and how each brocha underscores the recognition and the appreciation of those chasodim, then they develop that sensitivity to recognize and to appreciate good. And in the process, they become completely different people. They refine and purify their characters. I think it's also important to let our children know that refinement of character is the ultimate tachlis, is the ultimate purpose of Torah and mitzvahs. Chazal say, lo nitno Torah mitzvahs, Torah and mitzvahs is only given, ela letzarif ben esavriyos, to refine human character. And if they know that this refinement of character is the primary purpose of everything that we have, and it's one's personal responsibility to refine one's character. I believe here is another point that has been made in the past, but something which is very important to underscore. In our society today, many people, many kids especially, have not gotten the lesson or the message that they're responsible for themselves. That I'm responsible for my truth, and I'm responsible for my sensitivity, I'm responsible for my chesed, and I'm responsible for my akoras hatov and all my other midos. Because we have so many rules and regulations. We've made so many choices and decisions for them. We've pushed them in so many ways into pre-existing molds and control what they do. And many times this has to be that way. But the message subtly, which sometimes comes along, is that they're not really the ones who are responsible for themselves. And that being the case, there is some serious difficulty in terms of motivating them, because they don't even feel that that they can do anything about it, that they're the ones, it's not their problem. And we have to teach our children from the earliest stages of life that it is their problem, that they are responsible, and empower them to realize that they can develop positive traits. They can learn self-control. They can develop appreciation for the good that others do for them. Help them to develop it. Point it out. Show them when somebody did something to them, look what they did, and what can we do to show our appreciation to that person? And getting involved in acts of saying and showing their appreciation can make a difference in this midah, and this goes certainly for so many other traits. Now, there's a question here from a parent about how would a parent teach good midos to a teenager who doesn't seem to care about things like anova and kino? Well, the truth of the matter is that starting to teach good midos at the teenage years is a bit late, because so many of the midos by that time have crystallized and solidified that it becomes much more difficult. However, I think that what we have to do when we do attempt to teach midos, even in an older child, is we have to find those midos where they can identify more and appreciate more, and work on those rather than the ones that we feel that they don't really care about, as anova and kino. And if we work on the ones that they care about, or they can at least hear the importance of, it becomes easier and it becomes contagious. It seems from Rashi where Rashi says, where the pasuk says, "Oiso chachtol abduch liyitzchok," where Eliezer says that the one that will say "gam gamalecho ashke," "Oiso chachtol abduch liyitzchok," because she's gomeles chesed and she's therefore worthy to enter the house of Avraham Avinu, and the rebellion Mizrochi there says, "Dimloi kein loma bocha b'zeh ha-simen." Why did he choose this sign of chesed if it doesn't make her worthy? And it seems that the midos are connected, that if one is worthy in the midos ha-chesed, then it has an impact, or it's connected with the other midos. I think the reason for that is really very simple, because good midos is an emulation of the Creator. And if we set the Creator, the Boirei Olam, as the goal, Mahu Rachum, Mafato Rachum, and even if we connect and emulate only one trait, we've connected with Him in that way, and that connection then can spread to other things. So I think the Eitzah would be to start working on Midos, which are easier for them to deal with. Chesed is something they can appreciate. They want chesed from others. They appreciate, or at least they recognize the benefits of others doing them chesed, and therefore that's something that they can appreciate. It's also something that makes one very happy. The Ramban says, where the Posuk says, "Vayikach Yitzchok es Rivka oihel asoro vayeho hoveho," he took Rivka into his mother's tent and he loved her, and then he found Nechoma, and the Ramban says that he found a Nechoma for the loss of his mother in the love that he gave to his wife Rivka, not in the love that she gave him. I would have thought that if he lost his mother and he's looking for Nechoma and he has now a wife and the wife loves him as his mother loved him, that would be the Nechoma. The Ramban says the Nechoma that he found is in the love that he gives. He loved her. It seems that giving is a very, very consoling and soothing and uplifting and validating type of thing, and truly brings about a state of happiness. So if we work with these midos, which are easier to deal with, it would seem that we have a better shot at eventually reaching for midos which are more difficult to handle. Another question over here we have. I would like to have an open relationship with my daughter, but I don't want her to relate to me as her friend. What are some guidelines for striking the correct balance? Sometimes that's a difficult question. I do think that we should not be so afraid of this friendship with our children. I think we should rather look at it as a friendship, but it has a higher level relationship as well. Not that there is no element of friendship. And I think some of the guidelines are a delineation of the nature of the relationship and a discussion of it. In other words, a child that's old enough to talk with, and we explain to them, you know, I enjoy doing things with you, and I enjoy your company, and I ask your advice, and I respect your opinion, and we have this close communication between us. However, for your sake, I don't want you to lose sight of the fact that ultimately I'm responsible for you. I'm responsible for your well-being, for your welfare, for your future, and therefore, as such, I have to make certain decisions, and I have to insist on certain behaviors, and when it comes to your well-being or your welfare, whether it be physical or spiritual, your future, your education, and things like this, it can't just be, you know, that we're friends and we'll discuss it and work it out, but rather the responsibility placed on me. I wouldn't emphasize the wisdom as much as the responsibility, maybe the experience of age, but go easy on that. I think that would make it, makes it easier for a child to keep in mind the parameters, because those parameters that you're holding are really because you're concerned for me, therefore I don't find it as offensive. And I think that we can have a very close, friendly relationship with the proper respect and distance, because of the fact that we realize, or that the child will realize, that that which we are doing is for their benefit. We have here another question. My son is 16 years old. I want to teach him to view Torah learning as our primary goal, but I do not want him to feel like a failure if he does not end up studying in yeshiva long term. All right, this is, you know, these questions are not very easy. First of all, I think before we worry about failure, we should concern ourselves with assuring success. I find today that too many of our kids are or seem to be failing at their learning, not because they're not capable of succeeding, but rather because they have unique and different styles of learning, and with those different styles, they are they're not necessarily being serviced in the yeshiva, in a large classroom, as some students may not be good at just hearing a lecture or concentrating on a lecture or internalizing and memorizing information. They may need challenge, they may need give and take, back and forth. They may need to be involved in the whole discussion before anything, before they can really grasp or appreciate what's going on. And since people do have unique learning styles, it could very well be that the situation that they're in is not helpful or is not working for them in their style, but that they certainly have the capability to succeed. So before we prepare for their failure, I think we have to discover what is the unique learning style, what can we do to design a classroom or design a chavrusa or design a program that can recognize and address and appreciate and develop them according to their unique styles. However, I think there is another point which could also be kept in mind about this issue, and that is that from the earliest stages in life, it's very important, it's very healthy, and it's very it's critical for our children to weather the storms that may arise, that the goal in life is to be an Eved Hashem. It's to serve Hashem, to do that which Hashem wants from us. That is the highest goal of all goals. That's the ultimate, that's the tachlis. And what that means is that the goal in life is not to be a Rosh Yeshiva, the goal in life is not to be a great rabbi, the goal in life is to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And when we try to tell this to a failing student who for the first time in his life after 16 years has finally shattered his world because he sees he's not going to be this Torah scholar, this Talmud Chochem, and we try to tell him, well, it doesn't really matter. What you've heard until now is not to be taken literally, and the main thing is, you know, just to serve Hashem as best you can according to your koiches, according to your personality. It may be a bit late because this dream has been so nurtured and so developed so that one may not, it may not sit that well with him. However, if in fact this is something that he hears from his youth, and every time they aspire to something that we sort of redirect them and let them know, ultimately a person has to serve Hashem, and the thing that he wants to do and the thing that he's best at doing and the thing that he's gifted at doing and interested in doing, all of these things are part of the signs which lead us to know what Hashem wants from us. However, they are that is the general goal. And if that is the goal, then if a person cannot study for a long time in yeshiva and has to go out, then that goal is that will be more easily understood, because for me, that's what I'm supposed to do. That's what it's all about. And I think that might make the whole situation a little bit easier to deal with. Well, it's getting close to Purim. What are some things parents can do to make Purim less of a party day for teenage boys? Well, again, I don't know if we should try to make it less of a party day for teenage boys. I think the party day and the party part is something that they're looking forward to and that they really want. I would say the real goal, and maybe this is what the question means, is to make Purim a safer day for our children. And that is quite a tall order. I think that way before they get into the Purim mode, they have to begin to hear and to realize about the problems that exist when people drink, the dangers, the close calls, the embarrassment that so many kids have suffered because of this. I think as it gets a little bit closer, we have to have some type of an idea that if they can remain sober, and I think that really should be the goal, maybe at the Sudas Purim, just a little bit modified and moderated and controlled drinking, if that's called for, but not throughout the day and the night. And I think that if we could find some meaningful reward to reward them if they stick to this regimen and they don't get themselves drunk, then I think this can also be somewhat of a motivation. But I think the key really should be in finding other alternatives where they're going to be happy, where they're going to find it's enjoyable. A lot of these guys go around collecting futstocker, and they have all kinds of shtick, and they, now unfortunately there may be some drinking there too, but at least if they're engaged and if there's some proper supervision, which I don't know if there always is, and they have something exciting to do, and there's a goal, and especially if there are rewards for, you know, the group that collects the most money, and they come to realize that if they're going to drink and they're going to get trashed, they're not going to be able to continue, and they won't be able to win. I think this is something that they can relate to. I also believe on a certain level, they can relate to the fact that Purim is a day of simcha, and drinking is not really simcha. The Rambam says that the greatest simcha on Purim, if you've done the mitzvahs, is to give matonas levyonim, because there's no simcha like one that rejoices the hearts of downtrodden and broken people, because such a person is comparable to Hashem, and that, of course, is the ultimate validation. I think if we could find, whether it's a Teimche Shabbos or whether it's some other way of delivering Shalach Monas or of helping the less fortunate, I think that that can certainly be a validating substitute to make them feel good about Purim, feel good about what they're accomplishing, and might mitigate somewhat the drinking problem. It certainly is not going to eliminate it, or it may not really eliminate it, but at least it could help to a certain extent, and hopefully bring it under some modicum of control. My son is graduating high school this year and will be going to Israel next year. I am worried about him being so far away from home with so much freedom. What can I do from a distance to make sure that he stays on track? Oy, it's certainly a difficult question. I do know that Priority One has published some literature about that, which is which one should look into, either on the website of priority-one.org or to call the office at 516-295-5700 to get sent some of that literature. But I think it is a serious problem. I think some of the work has to be done before they go, and some while they're there. And first of all, the process of choosing the right school is critical, one with appropriate supervision. If there is, you know, there's not that much supervision, it's, you know, they're adults, it's like a college level, but on some level, if there is some sense of supervision there, that can make a big difference. It's also very important to try to choose a school where the student body is like-minded to what you would expect from your children, and you know, interested in growth and development rather just in partying, and that I think can make a difference too. It's very important to identify a mentor or a staff member, a mentor or someone with whom you can be in touch and who will be in touch with your son or daughter, and be aware of where they're going, what they're doing, how they're doing, and if problems are developing, if they're keeping to the curfew or whatever, and to have someone that you can contact on a regular basis, sometimes without the knowledge of your child, maybe sometimes with the knowledge, depending on the situation. But I think that that will also help in terms of, be very careful to be in close contact, you know, constant, regular contact with your children, but yet not to bother them too much, not to give them the sense that you're always looking over their shoulder and checking up on them, because sometimes it works the opposite way, and sometimes that sense of trust and confidence will enhance their performance rather than detract from it, and that could sometimes be very helpful. Also, it's not a bad piece of advice to be in touch with other parents who are in the same situation as children in the same school, and sometimes you get insights from one or another that you didn't get from your children. And of course, to be in touch with the administration from time to time, to really find out, to try to find out what's going on over there and what you as a parent can do to try to help. It is important to visit. Those visits mean a lot. It is important to write, despite how much you talk on the phone, but writing is something they get in the mail, they can read it. And it's important to send care packages and gifts and let them think and let them feel and let them realize that you're constantly thinking about them and aware of their plight. My 13-year-old daughter has gotten into a friendship with a girl who I feel is a bad influence on her. Should I try to limit their interaction? If not, what do I do if it gets worse? Is there a limit when I should force them to cut off contact? Well, unfortunately, we don't necessarily exert as much control on our children as we think we may have. Forcing to cut off contact might work. And it might just encourage a clandestine, meeting and going underground, so to speak, and really not accomplish very much at all. It's also a real no-no to speak against one's child's friends, especially a 13-year-old girl. It's certainly something that she will take great offense at. If you speak against her friends, so I think that it's probably best to be in very close contact with your child and monitor any influences, anything that's going on. It's wise to advise them to hang out in your house as much as possible without snooping in an obvious way, without interfering in any way, but just that they're there, they're in a safer environment. You get a sense, at least a little, of what's going on. It's important to talk, again, through having them come to the house and casual conversation, not through pursuit or overbearing, but to talk to the friends and to find out, have your eyes and ears open to hear what's going on and really to see what how the situation is really working. There are times when you might be able to suggest that this friendship is not good. If you have an excuse, if you have a if there's an incident, and often there's a fight, there's something, at that point you could use it as saying, it's not a force, not a push, not an absolute, but maybe it's not the best relationship for you. Look what happens, you might be better off with something else, and so forth and so on. It's also good to dilute the relationship by having encouraging as many other friends as possible, so that even if they have this friendship, if it's shared with a number of other friends, it doesn't have that same negative impact, so it could improve the situation a lot. My husband regularly sets aside time to learn with our son, but my son seems to be draining it more and more every time. Should they learn less often? Interesting question. Just a couple of thoughts. Why do children sometimes dread learning with their parents? Well, the reason that most of these kids give is that they feel their parents are just testing them. That it's a test, not a chavrusa. And some of them even add that it's a test and my father is looking to see how little I know or trip me up or to see that I don't know. And that's unfortunate that they feel that way. I don't think the answer is learning less. I think the answer may be learning something else other than what they learn in school, especially if it could be a learning project, something that they could work on together, maybe finish and have a siyum, go out to dinner, do something with some type of a reward for it. But something like that probably works better than learning what they're learning in school. The kid doesn't feel that he's just being tested, and it could be like a separate project. It's not just more of the same. Oftentimes, I remember an incident number of years ago where one of my young children just refused to learn with me. Was not in the mood, was not interested, it just didn't work. And I sat down and I remember for 40 minutes we talked about baseball. Believe me, I didn't know much about baseball. And after that, I got an hour out of him like never before. Like, we were drawn into the conversation and we're communicating already and there's a mutual interest in something and you know, you got my interest and I'm here already and okay, I'll give you the, you know, the little nachas. So I think sometimes that that could help. And also, there are times when it's appropriate to get someone else to learn. I don't think it should be a complete substitute for a father's learning, but certainly sometimes a mentor can have even a greater effect on a child than a parent. My son is generally a good boy, but I suspect that he is stealing. Should I confront him? Oy, well, first of all, I would say that there's two types of stealing. They're stealing from parents, and they're stealing from others. Now, there shouldn't be a distinction, but in the minds of children, there is. Children have a sense that that which belongs to their parents belongs to them. Maybe in a sense they feel it's like an early invasion, intrusion to their Yerusha. I don't know. But they feel that, you know, to take from the home, to take even from the pocket or the pocketbook is not the same thing as stealing. So I think that's an important distinction that we have to know. If we treat it the same as stealing, it might become easier for them to move outside of the house and steal. That having been said, even if it is, it has to be stopped and they have to understand. It's always wisest not to confront. It's always wisest never to confront before you are certain. A suspicion, a confrontation of a suspicion, which happens to be wrong, could be devastating to a relationship. So I don't think that's wise. I think a person should do their homework and make sure they know what they're talking about. And then, I think whether it's from the parents or from the outside, it does have to be dealt with, but I think it has to be dealt with, you know, as an educational process. It's wrong, but not only is it wrong, let me put it this way. The Rabbeinu Simcha, the Machzeh Vitri, says, Toiv Terum Derech Eretz, Shegia Shnei Mashka Chasovon. If you have Torah, and he says that refers to learning about the laws of stealing, and Derech Eretz means making a living, then the work put into both will forget sin. And he says that because when a person is working, so he has parnosa, so he's not so tempted to steal, and he studies the laws of gzeila, so together it's mashkachas, he doesn't even think, it's forgotten, stealing. Like, it doesn't dawn on me, I have parnosa, and besides that, I learned hilchas gzeila, it's so far removed from me. I think that could be an important thing to give him that sense of that it's removed from me. And I think one of the two points to the removal are, one, the studying about the gzela, so a person knows how terrible it is, it keeps it away. And the other one is the having money. In other words, some people, some kids, are stealing just because they don't have enough money. And if they feel that they have money and they have the money that they need to spend and they're not living on such a tight budget, then sometimes that can make a difference. Learning the Hilchas Gzela, learning the importance, learning the mitzvahs, learning it in the Rambam, learning can have a major impact, there's no question about it. And finding a way with minimal embarrassment to have to return, even to earn and then return that which was stolen, can sometimes have a therapeutic effect at leading a person to wanting to do something a little bit, to do something to bring this under control. My son enjoys learning practical things like halacha and interesting things like chumash. He finds Gemara to be dry and he is not interested. What should I do? Oy. You know, this is probably one of the saddest questions. liking to learn halacha and likes chumash is an indicator that he's a good kid and he really wants to learn. He knows this is Torah, he knows it's important. Gemara is dry, then there's something wrong. The Gemara is anything but dry. There's nothing as intellectually challenging, stimulating, energizing, exciting as the Gemara is. And therefore, it's impossible that such a situation could be real. Of course, it sounds like the classroom environment, the presentation, the interaction in the classroom is not working for him, and something has to be adjusted in his learning of Gemara. You know, there are many kids, I think we mentioned it earlier, many kids that have good heads and that could learn, but in a listening lecture, remain quiet, ask a question once in a while type of an environment, they don't flourish. They flourish when they're in the fray, when they're involved in battle, when it's an ongoing interactive, stimulating discussion and argumentation. And then that may be what's lacking for this kid, and therefore that should be developed. If it can't be developed in the classroom, and you can't change him to a different class or a different school, which may not be practical, then at least to engage a tutor or a mentor who can learn this way, the way that this child will find interesting. It can't be that a child who has any average intelligence will not find the Gemara to be interesting, exciting, stimulating, and challenging if, in fact, it's presented as such. So you must have a mentor who will be capable of presenting it and engaging the child in such a way. Oy, my 16-year-old son has gotten involved in a relationship with a girl. What can I do? Is there anything I can do to prevent this from happening to our youngest son? Unfortunately, this question is too relevant, and it happens far too often today. It's very, very difficult. The Nisyonis today, the breakdown of the barriers today is something that I don't think we've ever experienced before in Jewish history. And it's a very serious type of a thing. Probably as a parent, what we can do is quite limited. Although the basic tact just has to be that we're against this relationship, not for its religious ramifications, because once this relationship has begun, they know very well that from a religious point of view, this is not what's expected. But they're beyond that. The taiva has overwhelmed their religious judgment, and therefore that's not going to be the answer. And I think the tact that we have to take is that this is not for your benefit, that people get involved in relationships and eventually they continue on with these relationships and sometimes get married. And oftentimes it wasn't a very wise judgment because it wasn't based on solid thinking before the relationship developed to see if this person makes sense on paper. Rather, it's something they were already into, and now when they start trying to evaluate whether this is marriageable material, the blinders are up because I've spent so long getting to know and to like this person that I can't see objectively about the person. It cheapens their values of relationships between a husband and a wife because this is a relationship without responsibility, which is really not a real permanent type of a relationship, and they develop the wrong values, and it can hurt their marriage. The statistics are that to the degree that there is premarital involvement, it's to that degree that the divorce rate rises. So these are issues that they should be aware of. They should be aware of that there are halachic constraints, and even though they claim that they're not violating any halachic constraints, that was just true yesterday. And tomorrow and the day after, as a relationship expands, as they get more comfortable with each other, then everything begins to unravel, or at least it can. In terms of happening to the younger children, and by the way, I think it's more important that an outsider who has some experience in dealing with these things speak to them, because the parent can be perceived as having too many personal negias, you know, motivation. I'm worried about my reputation of my family, or as it says here in the question, I'm worried about my youngest son, or whatever it may be. Whereas an outsider, a mentor, a rebbe, a teacher, someone can speak objectively and just explain to them why this is in fact very, very detrimental to their well-being. In terms of preventing it from happening to the youngest son, I think that to whatever extent possible, the older child can be asked and can be expected to keep his relationship quiet. Now, it's not going to be perfect. They're going to know about it. But the less they hear about it and the less they see it, the less direct influence it's going to have on the younger children. I think also you have to explain to the younger children that this particular child fell into this relationship. It isn't the right thing to do. It's not a very wise thing to do. It's a very unhealthy thing to do. If the older child is somewhat cooperative, then maybe he will validate the statement that says that he really, you know, he fell in and he really wishes at this point he wouldn't be in it. That's unlikely, maybe. So at least to make that comment that really this isn't a very healthy thing and should avoid it from starting, because it just ends up with all kinds of difficulties and problems. And if they hear about this son's problems, that could help a little bit. But we must remember that ultimately, knowing and seeing that that relationship takes place will have a detrimental effect, or can have the most detrimental effect on our children, because what they see is what they relate to the most, not the explanation of the dangers and the problems. So we have to do whatever we can to minimize that that particular type of a thing. My son is just 6 years old, but I would like to start now to be sure he will always be interested in learning and not find it a burden. What should I do? I guess the first piece of advice would be make sure he plays a lot. Don't push the learning. Never forget the inimitable words of Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, "The Kinder müssen spielen." Children have to play. So don't compromise his play because you want to be sure that he'll always be interested in learning. In fact, the more that you push, the more you can be sure that he won't be so interested in learning, because that's the nature of the beast. Of course, on the level that we want to be interested, then learning has to be enjoyable. Never forget the Cheder Rebbe in Yerushalayim. And I was leaving after the summer with one of my young boys, was in the Cheder there, and he calls me over and he says, "I want to tell you what learning is about." And he told me, he says, "It's all about Lulei Toirosko Shashuoy. The Torah has to be like a toy, like a delight." That's what he said. Like a delight. It's just, it's fun. And this is the way it is. If it's fun, then they'll always be interested in learning. And at every level of learning, it has to be enjoyable. It has to be enjoyable as a little child. It has to be challenging, a question, thinking, feeling good about myself in the Torah. If the definition of happiness is validation, then validating myself all the time through the study of Torah is something that can be truly uplifting, and something that I'll always want to do, and I won't find it a burden. Now, also, I think that it shouldn't become a burden. It shouldn't be a burden. There have to be plenty of breaks. They have to have time to play. They have to have recreation. I once found a community where they were having a lot of serious problems with their children, and it came out that public recreation was not an acceptable alternative in that particular community. And the feeling was on Friday afternoon about Soy Shabbos, yeshiva boys should be learning, not playing basketball. And of course that could, for many, be a devastating error, because to remain interested in learning, it has to come with a well-balanced lifestyle. And if I don't find that I have other things and I feel that the learning is taking me away from the normal things that other kids are doing, then that's the type of a thing which I can be very resentful of. And that resentment will color even a natural joy and stimulation that I have in learning. So I think it's that, you know, double approach that's necessary. And at every stage of the learning, it must be enjoyable. We say in the Birchas HaTorah, V'harev no Hashem Elokeinu, as Divrei Sirosko, make the Divrei Torah pleasant, make them sweet, make them enjoyable. And that's really befinu v'fi amucha beis Yisrael v'niya anachnu v'tzeetzoeinu. And this is the way. Also, I think they have to see the joy that we have in learning. If they experience, if they connect, if they touch this joy that we have, if they see it, it's palpable. They see a father learning, talking and learning, learning with his chavrusa, alert and animated and excited and passionate. Then this, of course, and happy and enjoying, this, of course, can also make a difference even in the youngest child. But also remember a klal gadol, which is don't put too much pressure. The more pressure you put, the more resistance you get. My 16-year-old daughter has two sets of clothing. One she wears and another that she wears at home, which would not be acceptable in school. Should I give her space to wear what she is comfortable with, or would that be sending an inconsistent message? I think that I don't know which is the other set that she wears at home. If it's just what would not be acceptable in school but is acceptable in the parameters of tznius or of halachic parameters, then I think one should not make an issue. In fact, one young lady put it that if her parents make an issue about something which halachically is permissible, then that battle that she fights will eventually carry over to something which is halachically forbidden. But if that which is halachically permissible is allowed to go unnoticed, uncommented, then it stops there. So I think that it's, as a rule of thumb, it's probably better to give a little space. The more space you give, the within reason, within halacha, within propriety, the less resistance in general there is. And I don't think the message is inconsistent, because the school has a certain standard. They may, for the rabbim, go beyond the minimal standard of halacha, but and that's to be respected. But that doesn't mean that as an individual, a person is wrong. Maybe it isn't right. Maybe it would be better. Maybe they're the preferable approach. But to fault someone and to make an issue and to make a fight certainly would be a dangerous thing. You might win, but you might lose big. So it probably doesn't pay to put up a big fight or to put up any fight. Can you give me some ideas to enhance our Shabbos table? My husband works hard all week, and it is the only real quiet time that we have with our kids. Quality time that we have with our kids. I believe that we have something that comes out of our office, an email that goes out maybe every Friday or Thursday to Machanchim, and maybe some parents too. Some ideas, you know, Dvar Torah, something which enhances the Shabbos table. There are many such things. I would say that minimizing the long speeches and maximizing the involvement of the children would really make a big difference. You have different age children with different levels. Everybody has to be spoken to. If you talk the high stuff and the little kids get left out, it's it isn't quality time for them. Especially if they're forced to stay there. At least if you let them go play, that's one thing. But if they're forced to stay there, they have no shaykh as to what's going on, it can be very detrimental. So there has to be discussions on everyone's level, especially addressing the younger kids, because they're the ones that may need the most to be identified or to identify with this Shabbos experience. It would be wise for the husband or the wife or whoever could to prepare some ideas and some things, just like many people prepare for the Seder, the Shabbos table could be a similar experience. I think that singing is a very powerful thing, but singing that our children can enjoy. If our children don't happen to know the words of Kol Mekadesh Shvi by heart, and they maybe can't even read, then it would be much more appropriate to sing a song that they know from school or something that they will enjoy. Rewarding, you know, questions that are asked and rewarding with a lollipop or with something certainly is a good thing. But not only asking questions, but asking challenging questions, getting them to think, and rewarding the effort and maybe even the appropriate answer with something good, that sometimes means a lot more, because just to pass, you know, to give back the answers that they know about the question, the parsha sheet that they learned, is minimally satisfying. But to be challenged to think and then to come up with some real answers and good logic and creative ideas and be recognized and rewarded for it, I think that can make a big difference. I think we also have to be careful about guests at the Shabbos table. If you want real quality time with the kids, some people that do have to have guests for various reasons, sometimes they try to keep at least one meal that should be just for the family so that the kids could be of primary focus. Even if there are guests, I think that if they're from people, they'll appreciate that your kids are a primary focus. And if they're non-from people, I think they'll be amazed at how and enjoy seeing how the kids will be the primary focus. A good piece of advice is to sleep. I don't know if it's possible for people who work, but to try to get a little rest before Shabbos, maybe a little extra sleep Thursday night, so that when the person comes home Friday night falling asleep at the table, especially snoring, is not something that the kids take well in terms of enhancing the Shabbos table. My 17-year-old son has confided in his older cousin that he has real doubts about Yiddishkeit. Is that normal for a good yeshiva boy? What should I do? Well, I guess the part about is that normal for a good yeshiva boy, I don't know what normal is, but are there a lot of such instances today where good yeshiva boys have doubts about Yiddishkeit? That definitely is an issue today, and there are such people. There are a lot of people from time to time who have doubts. What should one do? Well, informing parents about such a thing is not always the wisest thing, because you really don't know how they're going to deal with it. If you can deal with it as a relative, an aunt or an uncle, it might even be something that's more appropriate. You're less emotionally involved and might be able to deal with it more rationally. In terms of what we should do, I think the first thing that a yeshiva child that feels they have doubts about Yiddishkeit, real doubts, as it says here, about Yiddishkeit, first thing they should be informed about is that that's normal. A lot of people do. In the process of growing up as a teenager, people doubt themselves at every step of the way. They're trying to discover themselves. They're trying to discover the world. They're trying to discover what makes them tick and what they're doing here in this world in the first place. And doubt is almost par for the course, questioning and reevaluating. And so there's nothing to be ashamed or afraid of, and it's not necessarily unusual. I think sometimes as a first aid, as a band-aid almost for such a thing, one might say that the greatest minds of history may have had moments, of Jewish history, may have had moments of doubt, and yet, you know, the Vilna Goyen, I'm sure, thought of many of the questions, or all the questions, that we can think about. And yet he remained the Vilna Goyim, the genius of geniuses, and so did the Rambam, and so did all of the other giants of our history. So that these questions, there are questions, and they may be legitimate, and there are many people that have them, but these people obviously found the answers. In terms of the individual, someone should be speaking to that cousin. I guess, if possible, the aunt or the uncle, if without telling the parents, unless the parents could handle it well, could orchestrate someone to strike up a relationship or speak to this cousin and see if somebody can talk to him and deal with the questions. Listen to his questions. Whoever is dealing with it will have to listen to questions, take questions seriously. Don't argue with the question. Attempt to answer the question. Don't disqualify or discredit or disgrace the questioner, but rather attempt to deal with the questions. And ultimately, the dealing with the questions is really almost secondary. The specific question has to be dealt with, because that's the buffer, the defense mechanism, the excuse almost, that is presently being used for my doubts or questions about Yiddishkeit. But ultimately, they have to be engaged in a program where they recognize the clarity of the testimony and the extent of the evidence that exists for the truth of Torah Misinai. The testimony is amazing, the whole system of testimony, the fact that the Torah is a document that clearly states that the first generation witnessed the miraculous events of Mitzrayim, witnessed the Maimed Har Sinai themselves, and they pass on this document that says, I witnessed. Millions of eyewitnesses pass on to their children the document that says, I witnessed. That has a tremendous power of testimony. They also have to realize that the Torah is replete with information that no human being could have possibly known at that time. And those two together, the testimony and the evidence, are unique in the annals of all religion. There is no religion that has the claim of eyewitness testimony, public eyewitness testimony, and public miracles, and evidence of information that no human being could have known, which is clearly validated today. So these are some of the things that they have to hear, and it's something that someone has to work with them. It usually won't happen in a lecture or two or a discussion or two, but it's something that should be monitored and should be sort of kept after over a period of time. And I think with the right mentoring and the right guidance and the right person helping this child, I think that the chances are very, very good that that these issues can be worked out. And for the most part, for most kids, they are worked out. I've been asked to just make here a couple of announcements. Everyone's invited to tune in every Wednesday for the live weekly webcasts. Parent Talk Live starts at 8:45 on Wednesday evenings. And Living with Bitochen, which is the study of the Chavos HaLevavos, Shara Bitochen, starts at 9:15. You can watch live on our website at www.priority-1.org. To keep up to date on all Priority One's programs and events, be sure to sign up for our email newsletter and type in your email address in the box below. After the program tonight, please browse through the Media Center on our website. You'll find a wealth of audio files on many topics for parents and teachers. Membership is free, and all of the speeches are available to download and podcast. Thank you very much. We have a few minute break, and then we'll begin the
Thank you for listening to this presentation brought to you by Priority One. Please visit us online at www.priority-1.org. That's priority-1.org. parenting.org, where you can download free audio and publications on parenting, teaching, and teens at risk. For more information or to make a donation, please visit us online or call 800-33-4EVER.